Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and it is all about constitutional compliance. And woe unto me, because I forgot to mention that we've got a candidate in Missouri that is actually running a campaign on full compliance with the Constitution. His name's Gerald Westrand, and we need, and he needs your help, and we need you to help him, because we need to have that champion, folks. We need to have somebody out there that is actually helping drive this concept of constitutional compliance so that people can start seeing how important it is and how much of what our world is that is unconstitutional. There's way too many people that don't even see all of the tyranny because they just think that it's legitimate. It's not. Government does not have the power to just agree and compromise to do whatever they want to do. We don't have that kind of government. They've been getting away with it for years. They want you to believe they can do it. And they're laughing all the way to the bank and getting rich off of us and basically subjugating us. And I dare I say, they're not saying very favorable things about you and I, the electorate, because they realize we're stupid. But the fact is, they're illiterate. Equally, we're all illiterate. And when we start schooling them that they can't be doing what they are doing, and they start realizing, oh, because I see it this way, folks. We send in nice people, and they don't know what to do, and they're being told, well, this is how it's done. Well, shoot, that doesn't seem right. And you go, and then over time, they start realizing, wow, this really pays benefits for us, though. You know, it's good to be the ruler. That's not our system. And they're being taught wrong. But they've been doing it for years. It's like second nature now of government just being tyrannical. They're going to take the, they're taking away parental rights. Who would have fathomed 40 years in the past? Go back to 1960, 1970. Oh, they're going to take away your parental rights. No, they're not. No way. Government, there's no way it can do that. And now nobody's even batting an eye. Better yet, there's not one organization that exists at all that's challenging the legitimacy of the Department of Transportation. And if we can prove that the Department of Transportation is illegitimate, then that's how bad we have been boiled as frogs. We haven't been boiled anymore. We're now actually in the chocolate and the cheese as a frog fondue. What do you think about that, Sean? How's that for a metaphor?
Delicious.
How's that for a metaphor?
Frog fondue.
Yeah, but we've been. Hey, don't worry, folks. Don't worry, folks. Most of us have been cooked so far and so long that we're not even crunchy anymore. Yeah. Anyway, okay. So we were just covering Mr. Pinckney's comments regarding the different branches. He covered the legislative. He covered the basic principles. He's also covering somewhat here of the executive limitations and so forth. So let's kind of go through what he covers in this last paragraph. And then actually there's a little below that, there's a little bit more. So we kind of have to slowly stream through this to get all the highlights. I'm not sure if you noticed that, but there are paragraphs that have highlights without little headers in front of them. And then we'll jump finally down to Mr. Pierce Butler. But let's get back to the executive limitations and then kind of scroll through these. And what I'll do, folks...
Can I bring up a go-back before we get started?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Sure.
On the last show, we were talking about the 11th Amendment.
Yes.
And you're right on the money. It was the states threw a fit because of Chisholm versus Georgia. And it was a case in 1793 where Chisholm was representing British loyalists, and he had done business with Georgia, and they refused to pay him, so he took him to court, and the Supreme Court found against the state, so all of the states freaked out and pushed this amendment and then ratified it, saying that the states were sovereign.
Yep.
Or was that exact thing?
Well, so, right. So, technically,
within days of the decision, proposals for a constitutional amendment began circulating.
So, technically, when you read Article 3, and we dive into the jurisdiction of Article 3, which is right there in Section 2, it states this: that the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under the under their authority. Now, if Georgia was doing some dealings that wasn't not necessarily doing a trade dealing, but people came, foreigners came to Georgia and were, you know, trying to buy goods or, you know, say, we want you to do this stuff for us, whatever it was. And Georgia ended up saying, you know, screw these guys, heck with this, what have you. And they said, hey, you owe us money, you owe us goods. We, you know, we've got an agreement here. And Georgia, for whatever reason, the state of Georgia's court decides that, you know, they don't have standing, what have you. Under the jurisdiction further down, it basically states that to controversies between two, or okay, so it says between a state and citizen. So the jurisdiction shall extend to between a state and citizen of another state, between citizens of different states, and so in other words, two citizens, not just necessarily the state government, between two citizens, as well as citizens of the same state claiming lands under grants of different states, and between a state and or the citizens thereof and foreign states or citizens or subjects. All of that was taken away from them. In other words, they couldn't get in their knickers unless it was arising under the Constitution now. So in other words, there had to be a actual legitimate treaty that was under the United States. If it's something that was under the authority of the state of Georgia, then that's it. The federal court cannot get involved. And so you're right. And I honestly believe that there was probably other things that were in the pipeline, or maybe there was another case that already motivated other states, and they all basically said, okay, we didn't like these other two, but that's really bad what happened down there in Georgia, and so give us an amendment and strike your ability to have jurisdiction over all of these different things. And there you go. It was done.
And I think that, what do you think about that statement on state sovereign immunity?
What do you mean?
Doesn't that bolster the argument that the states are sovereign entities in the compact theory that is the foundation
of
our cause?
Sure, absolutely. That is how the Union was framed. There's a term that we use called federalism. Federalism is a New Age term that they use to create this construction that we are not sovereign states. Because if you look at a federation is a sovereign nation that has administrative states in it, that there are some things that the states may have some level of sovereignty. The majority of the control has been granted, delegated to the federation or the general government of that federation.
So it's the reverse.
Absolutely, absolutely. So yeah. Technically, the words that we should be using today is not federalism. It is confederalism. If you look up the term confederalism, confederalism is, you know, staying true to, you know, the state sovereignty and operating within, you know, their bounds of their sovereignty as equally recognizing the limited sovereignty given to the general government.
Yeah, I believe we had this conversation before along the lines Confederacy in the Civil War.
Yep.
That was their intent, was to stress the Confederate part of it.
Yes. And the reality was that during the Civil War, federalism was on the rise. It was rampant. I mean, when the federal government in 1820 did this Land Act, and basically created the Public Land Act that mandated all of the new states to give up land so that the federal government could sell it and use the majority of the proceeds to benefit itself and share some of the proceeds with each of the individual states, that right there is, you know, a huge usurpation of power. Huge. Along with some of the other things that they had been doing. Right? Like the Missouri Compromise, so forth and so on. And it just kept on getting worse. Their involvement in the railroad industry and taking and earmarking land within a territory that was going to be, and granting that land to railroad corporations. And then when that state became a state, they didn't have control over that land. It was already deeded to the railroads when technically, and federal. And technically, all of that land should have been transferred over to the state. So, and this is why railroad companies had property that went 100-mile swaths from that railroad line. In other words, they were given these broad swaths so they could go out and just create a railroad through that swath. 100 miles.
Would you say that was analogous to the carbon pipelines that we're seeing today?
Actually, it is. So the carbon pipeline is probably the latest generation of land grabbing. In addition to prior to that, maybe parks and actually prior to that would be environmental grabs, land grabs for saving swamp lands, these types of things. And prior to that, possibly maybe parks and forests and those types of things. And then prior to that, you know, it's just been the succession of, you know, we'll take whatever we want from you. All we need to do is just give ourselves a justification and we'll do it. And so there you go.
It doesn't even break down really to the, I mean, the principle is within the land itself, but it's that control and that overreach that expands the government, because then they use that as a foot in the door, so to speak, to start, okay, now we have this land, so we're going to do this and we're going to do that.
Yes.
You know, since we've given ourselves the authority over this, now we're going to expand that, you know.
Right. And there have been attempts by the states, and successful attempts, where courts have recognized and kind of, and what usually happens when a court will recognize that the federal government is overreaching, what ends up happening is the federal government kind of just cools its jets, and they just, because it only applies to that one case. You got to remember that when a case goes through, it's not broad sweeping in a district court, what have you. A state court or district court, it's not broad sweeping. It's just, it applies to the outcome of that case. And so the reason that they kind of cool their jets is they don't want a bunch of states to kind of adjoin to that case to bring it to the federal court to say, We want you to review this because what you've done is you violated all of this. The real problem here, folks, is the fact that the court's involved in this. The courts. So here's the question. Do these cases arise under the Constitution?
No.
Then who is the competent authority in holding the court accountable? Are holding the federal government accountable? Who's the competent authority?
The
states. So in other words, going back to what Madison said, the states need to create the tribunal to decide for themselves it has to be both of material and willful. So Are the encroachments material and is it willful? In other words, are they doing this deliberately? And is it significant where it is impacting this? Absolutely, they're losing their resources. And it is willful. They're doing something they have no authority to do. Because the enumeration in the Constitution for the federal government regarding property, that the federal government can own only these properties within a state, only these properties, forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and needful buildings. There's no amendment to the Constitution to grant them the ability to have Indian reservations, the ability to have public lands. If I go backwards or from that point to today, then we'd end up with these carbon treaty things and so forth. And actually, see, the interesting thing is the federal government is not actively involved in these CO2 pipelines. These are corporations that are going in and they're using case law of precedents from the Supreme Court that the states can grant them those lands because, and they're just saying, hey, the Supreme Court supports this. And the states are bowing to these things. Hey, folks, right.
That's kind of what I was talking about with the expansion of it under their saying we have this authority.
Yes.
So now they can bring in all their buddies and, you know, they can bring their businesses and they can benefit from it.
At the expense of the people, correct.
Right.
And the people that are getting rich off of this, and we're not talking about rich, like Congress. The state legislatures are just getting a stipend. That's it. I mean, Congress is the one that's getting filthy rich. And Congress is the one that's allowing these things to actually be going out into the states. By signing these stupid treaties that establish we got to do these things. Now these requirements of, oh, we got to create a pipe, you know, we got to do carbon, trade and that type of stuff. Oh, okay, that's a federal law. Now they're going to start bringing it out to the states. And they're saying, hey, to satisfy this requirement that the federal government's created, we're doing these pipelines to achieve these states. And they're getting federal subsidies. That's the only involved. The federal government is involved in it, but it's not the courts. It's not going to the federal courts. The federal courts have already done their damage. They had already done their damage setting precedents and all this other crap. So, folks, you have to take your counties back. You have to. If you want to stop all of this stuff, if you actually want to get your state, you know, no longer being subjects to this federal king, Trump or the Supreme Court or whomever is ruling us the day, because we don't have a Republican form of government. We have a political form of, or party form of government. We have a corporate form of government. We have a judiciary form of government. We have every form of government, under a democratic form of government. We have every form of government other than the government we're supposed to have, a Republican form of government. Okay, so let's get back to Mr. Pinckney. Unless you got another go back. I appreciate the go back.
No, we're good.
All right.
And the executive, he said, though not constructed upon those firm and permanent principles which he confessed would have been pleasing to him, is still as much so as the present temper and genius of the people will admit. Though many objections have been made to this part of the system, he was always at a loss to account for them. That there can be nothing dangerous in its powers, even if he was disposed to take undue advantages, must be easily discerned from reviewing them. He is commander-in-chief of the land and naval forces of the Union, but he can neither raise nor support forces by his own authority. He has a revisionary power in the making of laws, but a two-thirds of both houses after a degree, notwithstanding his negative, the law passes. He cannot appoint to an office without the Senate concurs, nor can he enter into treaties or, in short, take a single step in his government without their advice. He has also to remain in office but for 4 years. He might ask then, from whence are the dangers of the executive to proceed? It may be said, from a combination of the executive and the Senate, they might form a baneful aristocracy.
Okay.
All power.
Go ahead.
Okay. All power being immediately derived from the people and the state governments being the basis of the general one, it will easily be in their power to interfere and to prevent its injuring or invading their rights. Though at first he considered some declaration of the subject on the subject of trial by jury in civil causes and the freedom of the press necessary, and still thinks it would have been as well to have had it inserted, yet he fully acquiesced in the reasoning which was used to show that the insertion of them was not essential. The distinction which has been taken between the nature of a federal and state government appeared to be conclusive, that in the former no powers could be executed or but such were as were expressly delegated, that an indefinite power was given to the government except on points that were by express compact reserved to the people.
Okay, so let me say this. What did they call the general government under the Articles of Confederation?
Was that the states?
No. So, in other words...
What did they call it?
Yeah, in other words, Continental Congress was the general government, right? Continental Congress is the general government that served the Confederation. What was... Yes. They had another name for it other than general government. Do you know what they called it?
No, sir.
They called it the federal government. Now, this is what confuses people, because a federal government is a government that is basically one that is serving either a confederation and or a federation or a confederation. That's a federal government. It is not necessarily a derivative only of a federation. So, In other words, they, instead of saying the Confederation government, they just said the federal government. I don't know, just because for simplicity, for whatever, but that's what they called the general government. And
well, that's Latin, isn't it? Confederation. So the con means with, or together. Okay. So that's why they would leave the con off of federal.
So, yeah, I possibly, what I do know is that because they use that term today, the lack of understanding, people leap to the conclusion that we are a federation because we have a federal government.
Right. Semantics. Okay.
There you go. Which is one of the reasons why people always go, why do you always refer to the federal government as the general government or a little f federal government? Not a capital F federal government.
Right.
Okay. Because both of those basically help stand out that this is not a federation. Because if it's a federation, that would be a capital F federal government. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Great. So these little nuances, that actually eluded me and elude most people, it took me time to figure this stuff out, and it was by reading these things. So that what you just read was really kind of a little blurb on delegated power. The next one down is a blurb on the militia, so let's go ahead and talk about that one.
We may be told a free government imposes no restraint upon the private wills of individuals, which does not conduce in a greater degree to the public happiness. But all government is restrained and founded in force. We are the first nation who have ever held a contrary opinion or even attempted to maintain one without it. The experiment has been made, and he trusted there would hereafter be a few men weak enough to suppose that some regular force ought not to be kept up, or that the militia ever can be depended upon as a support or protection of the Union.
Okay. So this is just a little insight that he's providing regarding this necessity of the militia and the fact that maybe the nation can't depend upon it. And actually, the first 10 years, it basically showed that they could. But what happened after that? Well, actually, we had the War of 1812 and so forth. So anyway, everything was going just fine until after the War of 1812. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me kind of, you know, go back to this, because we've covered this before when it came to this militia system, that the militia was the foundation of our national security. And it was working just fine. As a matter of fact, all the states joining the Union had a militia, and that militia was capable of doing its fundamental needs in protecting the state without having to call forth the federal militia to help protect them from invasion, what have you. In other words, each state was self-sustaining itself. Well, that was the case all the way up to Louisiana. Louisiana, when it was brought into the Union, they needed to have a militia, and they were, you know, being taught, being brought up that way. But if you really look at it, you know, Louisiana came into the Union in 1803. And in 1812, when it became a state in the Union, I don't believe it was fully self-sufficient. I don't believe it was. I believe they did everything they could to make sure, but I think that they cut some corners, if that makes sense. In other words, if you look at the, what is that, 9 years time span of, you know, it going from French hands into U.S. hands and becoming a state, that's very little time to actually help prepare the territory in setting up forts, magazines, and all of that. And as a matter of fact, the extension of the War Department of going out there to do that wasn't really necessary because it was that well populated. In other words, the existing system of defenses that they inherited from the French was sufficient, but it wasn't necessarily integral into the Union militia. But I believe that they just cut corners a little bit. However, after Louisiana coming in, even though it was capable of defending itself, after Louisiana came in, it shows and it is apparent with all states joining the Union after that, that a dependency on the cavalry and the dependency on the national defense system was being integrated into each of these states, which is one of the reasons why federal forts were being maintained and federal arsenals and federal magazines. And in some cases, the federal government, basically, I can understand the magazines and staging areas and things like that, but for having forward deployed forces sitting in existing states and not in territories was a violation of that state's rights. Because that should not have been federal forces. That should have been state forces. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So what he's talking about, I think, you know, is this glossing over of this great system that was quickly compromised, just like land, just like state sovereignty. In other words, if the state is more dependent on the federal government, how sovereign is it? But especially for its security. Yeah, so anyway, we can see that the very first 17 states were pretty well self-sufficient. They were standing on their own. They could defend themselves. And as we moved on, going into the West Expanse and so forth, starting off with Indiana, then into Mississippi, Illinois, Alabama, and so forth, we can start seeing how the requirement for a standing militia to guard itself when it became a state and the necessity of maintaining cavalry and federal forces within these new states kind of helps, you know, to me, it exposes this concept that the federal government was marginalizing the importance of self-sustaining governments. Which was basically marginalizing their sovereignty, period. So anyway, let's go back to the debates in South Carolina and jump down to Major Pierce Butler, where we can talk about the war and then it's General Charles Cotesworth Pinckney and the Honorable Charles Pinckney. So I got the Cotesworth wrong. Anyway, let's go ahead and get into what Mr. Pierce said, Mr. Butler.
One of the delegates of the federal, Major Pierce Butler, one of the delegates of the federal convention, was one of a committee that drew up this clause and would endeavor to recollect those reasons by which they were guided. It was at first proposed to vest the sole power of making peace or war in the Senate. But this was objected to as inimical to the genius of a republic. By destroying the necessary balance they were anxious to preserve, some gentlemen were inclined to give this power to the president, but it was objected to as throwing into his hands the influence of a monarch having an opportunity of involving his country in a war whenever he wished to promote her destruction. The House of Representatives was then named, but an insurmountable objection was made to this proposition, which was that negotiations always required the greatest secrecy, which would not be expected in a large body. The Honorable Gentleman then gave a clear, concise opinion on the propriety of the proposed Constitution.
Okay, so now, see, again, we're talking about the declaration of war here. And so where was that power to sit? It was brought up, well, let's give it to the president. No, that would give it to a monarch. No, we don't want the states to have control over that. We want the people to have control over that because we believe the people. And I believe it comes down to this, that for them to declare war, they have to create the appropriation. Where do all bills originate for the appropriation for anything?
The House of Representatives.
The House. So it does have to come from the House first. What has to happen is if there are secret meetings that we're finding that the Germans are doing something, this, and this, then the Senate will then expose House leadership to the information necessary so that they can create a bill for appropriation and initiate the declaration of war. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So Mr. Pinckney, General Pinckney, states this on the war and the treaty.
One of the delegates, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, one of the delegates of the Federal Convention, observed that the honorable judge, from his great penetration, had hit upon one of those difficult points which for a long time occasioned much debate in the convention. Indeed, this subject appeared to be of so much magnitude that a committee consisting of one member from each state was appointed to consider and report upon it. His honorable friend, Major Butler, was on the committee for this state. Some members were for vesting power for making treaties in the legislature, but the secrecy and dispatch, which are so frequently necessary in negotiations, evinced the impropriety of vesting it there. The same reason showed the impropriety of placing it solely in the House of Representatives. A few members were desirous that the president alone might possess this power and contended that it might safely be lodged with him, as he was to be responsible for his conduct and therefore would not dare to make a treaty repugnant to the interests of his country And from his situation, he was more interested in making a good treaty rather than any treaty, making a good treaty than any other man in the United States. This doctrine, General Pinckney said he could not acquiesce in. Kings, he admitted, were in general more interested in the welfare of their country than any other individual in it, because the prosperity of the country tended to increase the luster of the crown, and a king never could receive a sufficient compensation for the sale of his kingdoms, for he could not enjoy in any other country so advantageous a situation as he permanently possessed in his own.
Okay, so, and he goes on, folks, I can tell you, you really want to read all of these things. These are just highlights. But he's going on here and basically laying out, again, the complexity of declaring war. And so, again, it boiled down to money. The people had to pay for it. Doesn't matter whatever the secrecy was, there had to be a mechanism so that the people would pay for it. So, in other words, the Senate would work in their secrecy. And in many cases, the declaration of war was almost done unanimously because we were attacked. When America's been attacked, I mean, there seems to be more of a unanimous, not these, you know, secret debates that are going on. We need to declare war because this is happening. Give you a good case in point. The War of 1812. We were attacked. Hey, now this goes back to what I said a long time ago. Do we really need to declare war when we've been attacked? Somebody's declared war on us. Do we need to say, do we actually have to state the obvious? Okay, we're at war, folks, when we're under attack, right?
No, that would be pretty easy to figure out.
Okay, so Madison, I don't think he was worrying about Congress because everybody was running out of D.C. when they were attacking D.C. So Congress couldn't have declared war, but Madison, you know, started marshaling the troops and started fighting back. The only president, as a acting president, leading ground forces in an act of war. The smallest, the most vulnerable president we've ever had did that. So anyway, let's go down a little further and just at the bottom of this paragraph, and let's see what he continues on saying. Go ahead.
At last, it was agreed to give the president a power of proposing treaties, as he was the ostensible head of the Union, and to vest the Senate, where each state had an equal voice, with the power of agreeing or disagreeing to the term proposed. This, in some measure, took away their responsibility, but not totally, for though the Senate were to be judges on impeachments, and the members of it would not probably condemn a measure they agreed to confirm, yet, as they were not a permanent body, they might be tried hereafter by other senators and condemned if they deserved it. On the whole, a large majority of the convention thought this power would be more safely lodged where they had finally vested it than anywhere else. It was a power that must necessarily be lodged somewhere. Political caution and Republican jealousy rendered it improper for us to vest it in the president alone. The nature of negotiation and the frequent recess of the House of Representatives rendered that body an improper depository of this prerogative. The president and Senate joined were, therefore, after much deliberation, deemed the most eligible corps in whom we could, with safety, best the diplomatic authority of the Union.
Okay, so when you look at the idea of treaties, that's right. Congress is not in session all the time. Now, if we were attacked and/or we had to declare war when the House of Representatives was not in session, specifically the House of Representatives, because the Senate's always in session, or it's usually in session. In looking at the declaration of war, to be able to call forth the troops and everything else, they needed to recall. So it doesn't mean that they weren't able to, do the treaty, the negotiations, and in other words, yeah, we're going to go to war, we're going to do this, and make ultimately the decision, they still had to brief and get the House to pay for it. So, anyway, let's go down to the next one. And I think we will find this on slaves under the Honorable Rawlings Loudoun.
He believed the gentleman that went from this state to represent us in convention possessed as much integrity and stood as high in point of character as any gentleman that could have been selected. And he also believed that they had done everything in their power to procure for us a proportionate share in this new government. But the very little they had gained proved what we may expect in future, that the interests of the northern states would so predominate as to divest us of any pretensions to the title of a republic. In the first place, what cause was there for jealousy of our importing Negroes? Why confine us to 20 years, or rather, why limit us at all? For his part, he thought this trade could be justified on the principles of religion, humanity, and justice. For certainly to translate a set of human beings from a bad country to a better was fulfilling every part of these principles. But they don't like our slaves because they have none themselves, and therefore want to exclude us from this great advantage. Why should the southern states allow of this without the consent of 9 states?
So there Amazing. You go. So this is the paradigm. I told you that we're going to see a lot of slavery points, and the fact that they have to give it up in 20 years. And so you're going to actually see people say, well, I believe that after, you know, over the course of the next 20 years, when we get to that point, Congress has the choice of choose to regulate or not regulate, and they won't regulate because they're going to see what an advantage it is that we have slavery down here. I mean, that's, you're going to see these types of comments come up. And so, because with South Carolina, it was far more important to them maintaining slavery. It was far more important to them to go, hey, are we going to lose this? And they were very concerned. That was one of their key issues. So, all right. So next one, we basically hear Mr. Loudoun again talk more about slaves. Go ahead.
I think it's I'd like to make the point that when you look at what he said for his part, he thought this trade could be justified on the principles of religion, humanity, and justice. That just rings out to what's going on now and all the things that people justify by using religion.
Yeah, communism, all of these things for humanity purposes. Absolutely.
Same thing.
So I don't mention this very often, but in my first book, I highlight George Fitzhugh. George Fitzhugh was a professor that was advocating communism in the early 1800s, 1830s, and was advocating communism in the southern states to help protect slavery because he felt, and he was basically proffering the concept, that all people should be slaves if they don't have the ability to provide for themselves a better life. In other words, if they're trapped in a life of destitution and they can't offer their children and so forth, a better, you know, conditions and so forth, they're better off in slavery because they can have those things. And being slaves to the plantation, not government communism, but communism via the plantations and plantations kind of running government type of thing, if that makes sense. So anyway, it's interesting how...
It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense, but it's interesting.
I get what you're saying. But yeah.
It's interesting how they go around trying to figure out a new way to justify their evil.
Exactly.
There you go. Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. All right.
Judge Pendleton observed that only 3 states, Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina, allowed the importation of Negroes. Virginia had a clause in her constitution for this purpose, and Maryland, he believed, even before the war, prohibited them. Mr. Loudoun continued that we had a law prohibiting the importation of Negroes for 3 years, a law he greatly approved of, but there was no reason offered why the southern states might not find it necessary to alter their conduct and open their ports. Without Negroes, this state, one of the most contemptible in the Union. And he, an expression that fell from General Pinckney on a former debate, that whilst there remained 1 acre of swamp land in South Carolina, he should raise his voice against restricting the importation of Negroes. Even in granting the importation for 20 years, care had been taken to make us pay for this indulgence, each Negro being liable on importation to pay a duty not exceeding $10. In addition to this, they were liable to a capitation tax. Negroes were our wealth, our only natural resource. Yet behold how our kind friends in the North were determined soon to tie up our hands and drain us of what we had. The Eastern states drew their means of subsistence in a great measure from their shipping, and on that head they had been particularly careful not to allow any of burdens. They were not to pay tonnage or duties, no, not even the form of clearing out. All ports were free and open to them. Why then call this a reciprocal bargain, which took all from one party to bestow it on the other?
It seems like this became a real heated issue for them, right? Well, they're not done. Honorable Rutledge now says something. Go ahead.
Gentlemen should carry their views into futurity and not confine themselves to the narrow limits of a day when contemplating a subject of such vast importance. The gentleman had complained of the inequality of the taxes between the northern and southern states, that $10 a head was imposed on the importation of Negroes, and that those Negroes were afterwards taxed. To this, it was answered that the $10 per head was an equivalent to the 5% on imported articles, and as to their being afterwards taxed, the advantage is on our side, or at least not against us. In the northern states, the labor is performed by white people, in the southern by black. All the free people, and there are a few others, in the northern states are to be taxed by the new constitution, whereas only the free people and two-fifths of the slaves in the southern states are to be rated in the apportioning of taxes. But the principal objection is that no duties are laid on shipping, that, in fact, the carrying trade was to be vested in a great measure in the Americans, that the shipbuilding business was principally carried on in the northern states.
Now he's going through really a better granularity of the real effects and the compromises and those things. But still, it's all about justifying. It's all about trying to come up with, you know, are we really being served by this Constitution? So down a little bit further, we'll find in, let me see, in basically General Pinckney's comments, we have the treaties first. So let's do the treaties.
If treaties entered into by Congress are not to be held in the same sacred light in America, what foreign nation will have any confidence in us? Shall we not be stigmatized as a faithless, unworthy people if each member of the Union may with impunity violate the engagements entered into by the federal government? Who will confide in us? Who will treat with us if our practice should be conformable to this doctrine? Have we not been deceiving all nations by holding forth to the world in the 9th article of the old Confederation that Congress may make treaties if we at the same time entertain this improper tenet that each state may violate them? I contend that the article in the new Constitution, which says that treaties shall be paramount to the laws of the land, is only declaratory of what treaties were, in fact, under the old compact. They were as much the law of the land under that Confederation as they are under this Constitution, and we shall be unworthy to be ranked among civilized nations if we do not consider treaties in this view. Vattel, one of the best writers on the law of nations, says, "There would be no more security, no longer any commerce between mankind, did they not believe themselves obliged to preserve their faith and to keep their word." Nations and their conductors ought then to keep their promises and their treaties inviolable. This great truth is acknowledged by all nations. Nothing adds so great a glory to a prince and the nation he governs as the reputation of an inviolable fidelity to his engagements. By this and their bravery, the Swiss have rendered themselves respectable throughout Europe. This national greatness of soul is the source of immortal glory. Upon it is founded the confidence of nations, and it thus becomes a certain instrument of power and splendor. Surely this doctrine is right. It speaks to the heart, it impresses itself on the feelings of mankind, and convinces us that the tranquility, happiness, and prosperity of the human race depend on inviolably preserving the faith of treaties.
Okay, so let's, the next one's a short one that we can get in 1 minute, so let's go ahead and do the next one. Go ahead.
By the present Constitution, each state sends 2 members to the Senate who vote per capita, and the President has power with advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided 2/3 of the Senate present concur. This inconvenience attended the old method. It was frequently difficult to obtain a representation from 9 states, and if only 9 states were present, they must all concur in making a treaty. A single member would frequently prevent the business from being concluded, and if he absented himself, Congress had no power to compel his attendance. This actually happened when a treaty of importance was about to be concluded with the Indians, and several states being satisfied at particular junctures that the 9 states present would not concur in sentiments on the subject of a treaty were indifferent whether their members attended or not. But now that the senators vote individually and not by states, each state will be anxious to keep a full representation in the Senate, and the Senate has now power to compel the attendance of its own members.
Yeah, and actually they're getting paid. So if they don't show up, they don't get paid. So, as we can see, treaties kind of started playing big. And unfortunately, at this point in time, the little clause in the Supremacy Clause had not been highlighted. We'll definitely get to that in the Virginia debates, which means treaties made while under their authority is that little clause that means everything, because they cannot make a treaty that is not within their enumerated powers. I wish that that would kind of jump out of all of these. But again, their focus was really trying to talk about the importance that the federal government was making treaties versus the states and why they needed to do that so that they could be enforced. Because Rhode Island, and as a matter of fact, if you notice down a little bit further, we're actually going to be talking about Rhode Island and the problems that they caused. So this is where those types of things start coming out. They'll talk about the species of money, I believe, as well, because that was a problem that came out of that as well. So I'm presuming that either we'll have a go back in our next episode, or some of the stuff that we will read will obviously spark more debate. Folks, we're here to help. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. And we need your help. God bless.
If you listen to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.